You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Welcome. I'm Steve Chiatakis. We're about to motor out of the Santa Barbara Harbor with fisherman Jeff Mawson. First stop, the fueling dock to put some diesel in his boat.
Just heading out to Holly, trying to get it opened up to do aquaculture and grab mussels off of it.
We're headed to Platform Holly. That's an oil rig off the coast of Goleta. It's been pumping oil out of the ocean floor for nearly 50 years, from the time it was built in the 1960s until a nearby oil spill in 2015 shut it down for good. Well, now it's getting decommissioned. The wells are getting plugged up and abandoned. And Holly is not alone. Yeah, despite the domestic drive for more oil exploration to offset your hemorrhaging gas bill, lots of platforms off the coast are reaching the end of their useful lives. You'd think fishermen like Mawson would applaud the toppling of these platforms. He's had to boat around them his whole life. But over the years, Mawson says an entire marine ecosystem has formed in and around those structures, an ecosystem that he says he'd hate to see die.
I've swam through the platforms and underneath them numerous times. I've taken my own video, and I'm just amazed at the plethora of sea life that lives in and around them. They're bastions of biodiversity, and it's an irony. That's the irony of the story, really.
Today on Greater LA, KCRW's Catherine Barnes heads out to the open ocean to find out what parts of the aging oil industry may be worth saving.
If you walk along one of the many beaches in Santa Barbara, there's no doubt you'll see oil platforms poking out near the horizon. Up close, they look like something straight out of Waterworld. You know, the movie or the Universal Studios attraction?
This one here is pretty close to the coast, and it's in about 200 feet of water. It looks like it's got cranes and probably four or five levels on it. It's an efficient machine in our industrial age.
On Platform Holly lives a jumble of pipes and cranes, ladders and storage containers, along with dozens of crew members. They roam the walkways as Mawson watches from his boat. Some are offloading cargo. Others are injecting the oil wells with cement to seal them. Meanwhile, below them, pelicans and black diving birds called cormorants gather along the catwalk. Sea lions jump onto the lowest deck for some midday sun. Holly is one of 24 oil platforms off Southern California's coast, and one of 8 set to be decommissioned in the next decade. You see, oil companies agreed to close up shop responsibly as part of their lease agreement with the state and federal government back when these platforms were first built. That's already been decided. But the fate of the structures themselves, that's still up in the air.
So there are kind of three broad things that can happen, three endpoints to platform decommissioning, and this is worldwide.
Milton Love is a marine biologist in Santa Barbara.
At the extremes, you can leave a platform in place, completely in place, sticking up above the water with offices or whatever you want above the water. The second possibility at the other extreme is complete removal. And then something in the middle is leaving part of the jacket in place.
Let's walk through those three options: no removal, full removal, and partial removal. Fisherman Jeff Mawson is arguing for no removal. Under the water's surface, he says these steel jackets have become a rich marine habitat.
In the shallows, you get the mussels and barnacles like you would on the beach. And as you go deeper, you get more invertebrate. I've seen urchins that have settled and recruited and that are living on legs. And then you get the anemones and then the fish. It's just all here in one place.
Above the water, he says the structure provides shade for the organisms below, not to mention a refuge for those sea lions and birds. And just like crew members for the oil company currently live and work on the platform capping those wells, he sees a future where marine biologists and fishermen like himself could live here instead, farming the urchin and mussels growing below them.
To remove all of it, then you would have no place to conduct science or research or aquaculture or experiment with other new technologies that are coming.
But who would take on the costs and liability for all that? The oil company certainly doesn't want to maintain the full platform once it's not producing oil, nor does the government. Now to the other extreme, full removal. That's what most anti-oil groups argue for. They want to take all the aging oil infrastructure out of the sea, from the tippy top of the platform all the way down hundreds of feet to the ocean floor. They say oil companies need to uphold the contract they signed. But Love, the marine biologist, says full removal comes with some ethically questionable trade-offs.
Killing all that marine life is immoral, in my view. It's basically killing them for a bad career move. You know, you happen to settle on a piece of steel instead of a rock, and so you have to die.
Plus, how do you transport and dispose of steel legs, some as tall as the Empire State Building, and all of them covered in rotting sea life? What landfill or recycling facility will take that?
That ain't going to happen in the United States. So you're going to have to take them to China? You're going to have to take them to Bangladesh? Chugga, chugga, chugga. All of that fuel being burned, all of that pollution, huge carbon footprint. No one thinks about that.
Love argues for something in the middle of these two extremes, which brings us to partial removal. That most likely means cutting the platform at about 85 feet below the waterline, so that some of the marine habitat can stay in place, but boats can easily get by and the costs and liability of the structure diminish. In other words, it becomes an artificial reef, known only to sea life and the occasional diver. This idea is catching on. The Environmental Defense Center, for example, used to advocate for full removal, but new science showing underwater rigs as thriving marine habitats has changed minds there, including that of Kristen Hislop, senior director of the Marine Program.
It's really unique because these are man-made structures in the ocean that have had a history of environmental degradation, yet when you get under the surface, they have mussels and sea anemones and sea stars and all sorts of critters, which tugs at people's heartstrings.
Now, the Environmental Defense Center is moving in the direction of partial removal, especially since 2010, when the state legislature passed an artificial reef program allowing oil companies to turn rigs into reefs if it provides a net benefit to the environment. But Hislop says there's still a lot of details to work out.
And I kind of like to describe this topic as a choose-your-own-adventure, and it really matters how it all plays out. Where do we cut these off, and do we leave them in place, or do we topple them, or do we tow them to a location that makes more sense for an artificial reef? And then once they are artificial reefs, do we protect them or do we fish them? We have to make a decision about these.
Since Platform Holly sits in state waters, it's up to the State Lands Commission to ultimately decide which adventure to choose. A feasibility study for all three options, plus an environmental review, is expected to start later this year. And the state will be asking for your input. Meanwhile, Santa Barbara just shot down ExxonMobil's request to truck its oil coming from platforms off the coast of Goleta, which could lead to even more decommissioning in the future. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. If you know the name Hrishikesh Hirway, it's probably because of his podcast Song Exploder, which is now a series on Netflix. In it, he goes into detail with songwriters like Lin-Manuel Miranda about how one of their songs came together.
I was on year five of working on Hamilton. At this point, it was called the Hamilton Mixtape.
I'm actually working on a hip-hop album. It's a concept album about the life of someone I think embodies hip-hop, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton.
But before becoming a podcaster who talked to composers about their craft, Hirway was himself a musician and songwriter, putting out music as the 1 AM radio. Well, now he's got a new EP coming out called Rooms I Used to Call My Own, and this time he's put his own name to it.
Strange how small it is when all is left is emptiness, the floorboards and the walls. Will they remember us at all? We've had to learn how to lose.
That's a song called Home from his new EP. And Hrishikesh Hirway joins us right now. Hi, Rishi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
It's nice to have you here. And, you know, Song Exploder has been such a big hit. How did doing this successful podcast and all your other collaborations affect how you wrote all this new stuff? I mean, like what was it that got you to do Home?
Well, you know, when I started Song Exploder, it was because I was in some pretty deep writer's block at the time. And I thought maybe I could try this podcast project as something just to use my brain while I was trying to figure out how to write songs again. But then that period ended up stretching for a really, really long time, years, in fact, and I didn't know how to get out of it. But because of doing Song Exploder and listening to all of these songwriters and artists and producers talk about the ways they worked, some information slowly started sinking in. It took a long time. But one of the things that kept coming up was how important collaboration was for so many people's process. And that was something that was a little foreign to me. And so to finally get out of writer's block, I turned to trying to collaborate with other people. And it worked. And now I finally have new songs of my own.
You used to record as the 1 AM radio, as I mentioned, but you're putting out this new EP under your own name. Why did you decide to change your musical identity to Hrishikesh Hirway?
Well, you know, part of it was practical and part of it was philosophical, I think. At a practical level, you know, I had changed all of my like social media handles and my website and everything to just be my name over the years from the 1 AM radio, because I started doing all these other things. You know, for a long time I was just doing music, but then I started doing Song Exploder and other podcasts and then the TV show, and it was easier to just sort of identify as myself in all of those things. And so just kind of continuing down that path, it made sense to put the record out under my name. But there's another reason for it too, which was really the reason why I started using the name The 1 AM Radio originally back in 1999, which was, you know, at that time, I remember playing my first few kind of solo shows under my own name. And I remember I got some questions from people basically wondering if the music was going to be Indian music or if it was going to be like world music, I think was the term that I heard at the time. And I felt really self-conscious about the idea of like having my music be prejudged to be in a genre that it wasn't, you know, just based on my name. And so there was something pragmatic about it at the time, but it, you know, to be totally honest, it broke my heart a little bit that I couldn't just sort of, freely use my name in the same kind of way. But I think that things have changed, in the 20 years since then.
Well, there's got to be some pride, right? The fact that you've been successful and people know who you are. A lot of folks know who you are, right? And you're able to put that name out without the preconceived notion that other people might have.
Yeah, I think that pride is a good term for it. I think I do feel some pride about being able to like use my full Indian name. I mean, Hrishikesh is not an easy name. And I think there's something... maybe I take some pride in being able to be saying like, no, this is my name and you know, you can deal with it.
Right. I want to ask you about one of the other tunes on the EP, which is called Between There and Here. And this is also a very, a personal song, a really moving song. Would you mind talking a little bit about the inspiration for it?
Yeah, actually yesterday was my mom's birthday and this is a song about my mother. She passed away in 2020. And
I'm so sorry.
This was a... Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was pretty unexpected. But then, you know, a few weeks after she passed away, I had a dream about her. And we had this conversation. And it was actually a really wonderful dream. It was really sad, of course. But But in the moment, it was really nice. And it was extremely normal, just like a normal kind of conversation, the kind of conversation I hadn't actually been able to have with my mom for a while, because she'd been ill for the better part of a decade or so. But it was like some memory of her from a couple decades ago, talking to me, and it felt like her. Anyway, I woke up, and the next morning I was supposed to get together with my friend Jenny Owen Youngs, who I write a lot of music with, and we were supposed to try and write together. But I had just woken up from this dream, and so I went in and said, I would like to write about this, and that's what led to this song.
You called out my name, bring me some water, my love, and it all felt the same as any other.
One of the things that's really special for me about that song is there was a part sort of in the bridge where I wanted to kind of include my mom in a way, because she used to really like hearing me play, and she used to listen to my music, but she never knew what the words were. She always said, you know, you sing too fast for me to understand the English, but she would hum the songs often, and I would hear her humming. And so there was a part in the bridge that I hummed, but then later I had this incredible offer from Yo-Yo Ma to play on the record, and I asked him if he would replace my humming, if he would play cello in that part. So he sort of plays the part of my mom in the song.
Would you mind that humming? Could you do a little bit of it?
Sure. It goes.
And there is Yo-Yo Ma, one of the most famous cellists in the world. How'd you get him?
Yeah. I can't believe that happened. He's somebody who I met originally through Song Exploder. He was in LA, and he came to my house, and we recorded an episode of the podcast. And then later, he was on another podcast that I did during the pandemic, a show that I made with my friend Samin Nasrat, who's a chef, about trying to sort of get through pandemic cooking. It was a show called Home Cooking. And I asked him if he would come talk to us about just a joyful memory around food, because we were trying to make a show that felt sort of happy and full of delight, even though we were in a really anxious time when the pandemic started. And he talked to us about memories of, you know, being a child in France and the smell of fresh baked bread on the street. And you know, we just stayed in touch, and I ended up doing a couple other things with him, and he's just a really incredibly wonderful and generous person. And one time when we were in conversation, I told him about this record that I was working on and sort of my dreams to get back to making music again, and he made this offer.
How did podcasting become such a big thing for you? Where did it come from?
You know, I think the appeal for it for me originally was how DIY it was, which was something that I had lived with as a musician for so long. You know, I kind of grew up in a DIY punk tradition, and what I liked about podcasting was it was similar, that you could kind of just do it without having to ask anyone for permission. And at least for me, as a musician who I already had a microphone and I knew how to edit audio and I had Pro Tools, it was something that I felt like I could just make this. I didn't have to wait for anybody to green light it or anything like that. And that was really exciting for me. And, you know, I could make an episode and then a couple of weeks later after I finished editing, it could just be out there. And once people started listening to Song Exploder, it felt like a really exciting way to just connect with people. I'd really only connected with people through music before, but here was this other mode. And then I just got excited about all the other kinds of podcasts that could be made, you know, the different formats and the different topics. And since you could just sort of do it yourself, every time I got an idea for one, I would just say, okay, well, let's try it.
And you do it yourself at home here in LA.
That's right.
Do you see the creativity of LA emboldening you?
Yeah. I mean, the whole reason why I'm here and doing what I'm doing is because I wanted to be around people who were doing the things that I was really excited by. And I have to say, like, it really lived up to what my dreams were. I know that might not be the case for everybody who moves here, but for me, I really love living here for the people and all the things that get made here.
In the chorus of the song Stillness, you sing, "Let your stillness fill this house in troubled times." We heard home earlier. There are a lot of references to home and home life in these songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that something you're preoccupied with? And tell us about the troubled times. I mean, are they the troubled times that we're sadly all seeing right now?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote that song in 2021. It was a few months after my mom had passed away. And of course, we were still deep in the pandemic at that time. And it was sort of pre-vaccination. And the end was sort of nowhere in sight. And I don't know if the end is in sight now, but it was really unclear then. And, you know, it was really a song about my wife, who is a very calm and a gentle person, and who I look to a lot when, you know, both for actual comfort and just for inspiration in the moments when my anxiety about life and work and the world keep me from sleeping, and I'm just, you know, my mind is racing and racing and racing ahead.
Sing low to me. You know the one, the country song that your father loved.
Hrishikesh Hirway, musician, podcaster, on the songs that we've listened to, by the way, are all on YouTube. The full EP is out at the end of the month. Rishi, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about this, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to talk to you.
Your quietness.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. And before you leave us today, we wanted to mark a somber anniversary. It was 2 years ago today that we learned of the first death from COVID-19 in Los Angeles County. With everything the pandemic has leveled at us since, it can sometimes be hard, right, to see the bright side. But LA neon artist Tori DiPietro hopes she can help you see the light at the end of the pandemic tunnel. Literally, see the light. Her neon art installation is lighting up the 3rd Street Tunnel in DTLA with the colors of the rainbow and her love for Los Angeles. And Tori joins us right now to talk about it. Hey there, Tori.
Thank you for having me.
On this somber occasion, obviously marking the 2-year anniversary of the first death in LA County, what gave you the idea to do an installation like this? Was this just about let's focus on the end of the tunnel?
Well, I was actually inspired by all of the darkness and all of the hardship that we were all collectively facing together. And I really did want to send a message of hope. And at the time, I really had no words. You know, I couldn't offer a time or a place that things would be better, but I could say that there would be light at the end of the tunnel. It would come. So that's when I came up with the idea for this and got right down to business.
And describe it, Tori. I mean, what is this art installation? We're talking rainbow colors. We're talking a heart. What does it entail, and how did you go about doing it?
So it's a 22-foot red neon heart that's at the end of the tunnel. And then the Third Street Tunnel, if you know it, it has those giant beams coming out as you exit. So I've filled each one of those beams with a different color of the rainbow. So it's a literally a giant rainbow and a giant heart. And I've signed my signature of Los Angeles over the heart. So I gave us a heart of the city and this rainbow, which to me was really intended to be a beacon of hope and a place where all of our hearts could physically meet with love for our city and our community and each other. So it was really just intended to offer something bright in this time that we were all facing that was so dark together. I personally had never in my lifetime witnessed, I mean, I'm sure so many of us hadn't witnessed the entire world collectively going through something so dark. And so I thought in that moment, we just needed to make some massive, huge act of light and love. So this giant rainbow seemed like the best thing to do. Now, at the time I set out to do it, I was very naive. I thought it was going to be this very simple thing. So I contacted my producer, who was the head of cultural affairs here in Los Angeles for 25 years, Adolfo Nodal, and I pitched him my idea. And he actually just agreed to be my producer on the project. And he worked with me for 23 months, cutting all the red tape to get it done, funding it. And we raised the money ourselves and did all of that. And it's entirely independent, artist initiated. So if nobody asked me to do it, so if it wasn't something the city was planning without me. So it was quite a feat to get it done. But I'm so happy that it is done now. It seems to be being very well received by the community, and that's been made it all worth it.
What's so special about neon?
I think it's just so bright and powerful. It has the ability to transform any space, wherever you put it. So for me, once I touched it and started working with neon, there was nothing like it from there. And I've been lighting up things addictively ever since. It's just I love it so much. And I really love the piece there at the end of that tunnel, because I feel it's, for neon work, it's actually a very different piece because it's considered light and shadow work. Typically, when you're looking at neon, you're looking directly at a neon sign, right, where the neon is exposed and you're looking right at it. So this is actually hidden in the beams and hidden behind the heart, and all the glow you see is primarily shadow work, where light really clings to all the dark shadows, which is so fitting for the topic of what we're talking about and what it was intended to do.
How long is the installation going to be up? How long can folks go see it?
It has a 2-year permit right now, but I do plan, when I built it, I intended for it to be forever. So I do plan to go through the process of making it permanent before my permit is up. So hopefully it's going to be forever, but it's definitely there for 2 years.
Do you have any other plans around the installation? Is there anything going on with it?
Oh, yes. We have all sorts of fun plans. In June, we are planning a cultural festival in the tunnel, music, food, all sorts of things to sort of celebrate the melting pot that is Los Angeles and shine a light on all of our multicultural communities here. So we're doing that in June. We're going to do some community improvements. They're building a metro station right there. So it's a great piece for pedestrians to be able to walk through. So there's all sorts of stuff we're just getting into the process of beginning the planning for. My producer is aiming to rename that intersection actually as Rainbow Square and really make it a space for the community.
Well, again, this is the Third Street Tunnel, downtown LA, one of the two tunnels that goes under Bunker Hill. Neon artist Tori DiPietro and her latest work there. You can follow her on Instagram, by the way, at Tori DiPietro. Tori, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this evening. Next week, when COVID hit, the way a lot of folks in LA lived and worked changed, and people moved around, but to where? That's next week on Greater LA. Hope you can join us there. Hope you can join us online at kcrw.com/GLA. You can share your thoughts there, tell us what you want to hear, and of course, grab the podcast while you're there, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Andrea Bautista, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show this evening, and we say a teary-eyed so long to our longtime producer, Catherine Barnes, who is embarking on a podcast future. We wish you, Catherine, a world of good luck, and thanks for everything that you brought to our show, Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your time and attention tonight. Have a great night.